To say that things were tense on the Hudson River campus of the Rye Manor School for Girls would be to understate the case fairly recklessly. Its evaluation by the Independent School Association 5 years earlier had been a near-death experience. The school was in peril of losing accreditation, which would be the same as a bullet to the brain. Today, for its progress review, the very young head of school, Christina Liggett, was so anxious for things to go well as she waited for the visitors who would decide her fate that she had spent much of the time since lunch in the ladies' room, her intestines in an uproar. Her entire board of trustees was also in town, currently meeting in executive session. Unbeknownst to anyone outside the room, their discussions had become uncivil when the treasurer revealed that he had, on his own, started exploring with bankers and others the nuts and bolts of selling the campus and merging what was left of the school with a third-rate boys' academy in Connecticut. The president of the board, whose daughter was the fifth generation in her family to attend Rye Manor, was weeping with anger at this betrayal, especially egregious since the treasurer was a real estate developer himself, and thus had a shocking conflict of interest. A third trustee had made an emotional speech about protecting the loyal faculty, who in some cases had spent their entire professional lives at this school. A fourth noted his daughter's opinions that the longevity of the faculty was a very large part of the school's problem. "It's a school. It's not a nursing home. They live in school housing. They have no equity. Where are they going to go? They should have thought of that themselves. They should have been saving. On what we pay them?" And so on. The school had once mattered very much in certain privileged circles of the United States. Prudence Milbank Culbertson, a society suffragist who had been force-fed like a goose during her famous prison hunger strike, was actually buried on campus in a grove of weeping birches. But by the time redoubtable educator Maggie Detweiler and her evaluation team set foot in Rye-on-Hudson, the days of commencement addresses delivered at Rye Manor by sitting vice presidents or justices of the Supreme Court in honor of their graduating granddaughters were long gone. Maggie had yet to measure the attitude of her two colleagues, but was herself torn between sympathy and annoyance that such a valuable institution, a beacon in the history of women's education, should have been allowed to flounder so spectacularly. As one who had for years faced the challenge of leading a famous school in a changing world, she was no sentimentalist. She saw Rye Manor as a textbook case of privileged people thinking that excellence was a birthright, not something that must be earned over and over. Now, with scores of jobs and careers at stake, it would be up to Maggie either to give the place another chance or to recommend a final merciful shove. She expected to be about as welcome on campus as an Ebola outbreak. Maggie and her colleagues made their way along paved paths across green lawns under ancient specimen trees and toward the administration building, observing everything from the trim of the grass to the slightly tattered edge of the American flag flopping fecklessly from the central flagpole, while in the board meeting the arguments raged. There was a faction that wanted to change the focus of the school entirely by recruiting heavily in Asia. "There's plenty of money in China and Japan, Korea. The oligarchs want their kids to speak English like Americans. They want them to go to Harvard. They'll send them as young as 9. "That's never been our measure of success, sending everyone to Harvard." 9? Who would send a 9-year-old to boarding school?" "My parents did," said Hugo Hollister. All heads turned to him. "It saved my life. Wonderful school. If I'd stayed home with my family, I'd be, I don't know, in prison by now."